Efortum. The house is thick with soldiers. 30 or more. Lolligan folded his arms, elbows tucked tight to his sides.
I'm afraid we'll need to revise those numbers upwards.
How so? His loyalists in the city can't have heard yet.
The ship Morn told us about,
Lolligan said.
It landed at Jacob's while you were still in the water. It launched just a minute ago. It'll be here any moment.
Crouched among his blankets, Blaze laughed in disbelief. How many men do you have here? Lolligan glanced between Ulwin and the masked woman.
Mercenaries? Just 20. We sent messengers into the city as soon as Morn mentioned trouble, but it could be an hour before reinforcements arrive, if they arrive at all.
Blaze stood, shedding his blankets. Bring me my swords. Lolligan drew back his head.
You're not serious. You just swam across a freezing lake.
And after a feat of heroism like that, I'd be especially upset about getting stabbed to death. Swords, now! Lyra rose. I'll need mine as well.
Mine too.
Dante didn't bother to stand. For whatever good it'll do me. Servants brought their arms, along with an assortment of armor from Lolligan's stores, most of it antique. Blaze wrapped iron-banded braces around his forearms. Lyra tried on a chainmail shirt, hurrying through her forms to test its flexibility. Dante lifted a tall shield. The enemy would be bringing archers, but it pulled on his arm with untenable weight. Across the lake at Jacob's, the newly arrived ship rowed from the pier, lanterns off, and hove toward Lolligan's Island. Lolligan's men swarmed to the northern beach, a flat stretch of rocks that stood just about the waterline.
"Pile that beach up with junk," Blaze gestured. "Anything we can hide behind."
Soldiers and servants hesitated.
Blaze turned to Lolligan.
"I'm going to start grabbing furniture, all right?"
Lolligan grimaced, twisting the end of his pointed mustache.
"Just leave the chairs with the blue felt. They were my grandfather's."
He ordered the back doors propped open. Blaze jogged inside and came out with a wooden chair over his shoulder. Seeing that, Lolligan's men streamed into the house. The old salt merchant shut his eyes to the ransacking. His mercenaries came out with chairs and tables. Groaning pairs of men hoisted couches and mattresses. A team of four lurched under the weight of a dresser. Wood cracked inside the house. Two servants hustled outside, grinning madly, a door held between them. They piled it all in front of the rocky beach. The ship loomed nearer, oars churning from both its decks. Blaze ordered Lolligan, Fan, and the servants inside. Fan fiddled with his hat.
"That will be away from the fighting, yes?"
"Unless things go bad," Blaze said.
"Excellent."
Fan and the others hurried inside. Morn joined the soldiers on the beach, as did the woman in blue. They both carried bows and thick sheafs of arrows. They were barely in place before the first arrows flew from the ship. These splashed in the water and plinked from the beach, testing range. A shout went up. The ship's oars backbeat against the lake. It slowed to a halt within easy bow range. The arrows ceased. Cassander's soft voice boomed unnaturally.
"Three people have to die. Those who killed Bill Jacobs. If you prefer, all of you can die as well."
Blaze vaulted onto an overturned couch.
"If you prefer, you can kiss my ass, and you know where it's just been."
He ducked as an arrow whisked over his head. He leapt back behind the makeshift walls of furniture. Cries rang out from the ship. Chains clanked and creaked, lowering longboats from each side of the galley. Volleys of arrows covered the soldiers' descent on the rope ladders. Dante counted roughly 20 men per longboat. Another 20 archers in the prow. An unknown number of soldiers in reserve. Lolligan's troops were outnumbered at least twofold. If the galley's decks were full, as many as 100 soldiers might stand against them. Dante took out his knife and carved a red line across his arm.
"Can you at least not smile when you do that?" Blaze said.
"Was I?"
"Always. It's like your forearm killed your mom and you're giving it the death of 1,000 cuts. It's got so many scars, it's no wonder you didn't bother with a shield."
Morn sniped at the archers on the deck, knocking two into the water. An arrow threaded through the barricade and pinned one of Lolligan's men to the ground. The mercenary writhed, screaming. Dante ignored him. He needed all his energy. The longboats shoved off from the galley, shielded at their bows by thick hides. Dante lobbed a spike of nether at one of the archers on the galley. The man staggered, gagging blood. Dante smiled. Cassander hadn't tried to stop him. He closed his eyes and let the nether come. Shadows coated his hands to the elbows. The longboats stroked forward. When they were halfway between the galley and the beach, Dante stood, oblivious to the arrows hailing down around him, and flung out his hand. The side of the rightward longboat exploded in a hail of splinters. Men hollered, shielding their faces from the shrapnel. Water gushed through the yawning hole. Soldiers leapt up to bail it out with buckets and bare hands. Morn and the woman in blue popped up to pick them off. Soldiers flung themselves over the broken longboat's edge, paddling for shore in heavy armor. Most sunk beneath the placid waves. The second longboat beat on. Flaming arrows whopped into the barricade, driving the mercenaries into cover. Fire licked over feather mattresses. Other arrows arced far overhead, clinking on the clay roof of the house and clacking into the wooden walls. Two servants dashed from the house, one carrying rags and a jug, the other with a flaming brand. An arrow knocked the man with the torch to the ground. The man with the jug raced on, skidding into cover beside Morn, who poured oil on a rag, knotted it around an arrow, and glanced at the empty killing fields between the barricade and the house. He poked his arrow into the flames of a smoldering table, lighting the oily rag, then fired into the front of the galley. The hulled longboat slogged on, barely above water. The other ship groaned to a halt on the shore. With high cries of battle, men piled over its side. Blaze thrust up his sword and dashed through the burning furniture. Dante's body buzzed. He leapt to his feet and charged after Blaze, Lyra right beside. Lolligan's soldiers cheered and joined the charge. The galley's arrows felled two men before they met the invaders. As Blaze closed on the enemy, a spear thrust at his body. He met it with his left-hand sword, intercepting it near the tip and letting it slide past his chest as he closed. He drove his other sword into the spearman's exposed gut. The man in the red and white of Modigan's soldiers chopped diagonally toward Lyra's neck. Forearms crossed, she knocked aside his blade with hers, then grabbed his sword hand with her empty one, pivoted, and slung him over her hip. He cracked into the rocks. His helmet jarred away. With a backhand swipe, Lyra cleaved in the side of a skull. Behind her, a man cocked his sword and drove it toward her spine. Dante splayed his hand. A black blade severed the man's hand at the wrist. It fell to the rocks, still clutching his sword. His stump continued its forward thrust. His grin fossilized as his eyes tried to process the bloody absence where a hand and its weapon should be. He swayed and collapsed into the rocks, kicking. Blaze pivoted away from an overhand strike and spiked his blade into his attacker's extended neck. The man sank to the hilt, gargling blood over Blaze's hand. Blaze pivoted again, turning the man's body into an incoming spear. Its point pierced deep into the dying man's back. Blaze slid his sword free and shoved the man to the ground, yanking the embedded spear away from its wielder. The disarmed man backpedaled, tripping. One of Lolligan's soldiers dropped to one knee beside him, stabbing the man through the chest. An arrow streaked toward Blaze. He sidestepped and struck it down mid-flight. A man in red charged Dante, a rectangular shield covering him from chin to shins. Dante held his ground and fired a bolt of shadows through the man's eye. The body tumbled forward onto the shield, skidding over the rocks. Firelight lit the rocky shore. Every man in red lay among the wet stones, writhing or silenced, dying or dead. A burning arrow shot lanced from the barricade into the hide shield on the banked longboat's prow. Blaze hollered and swung his sword in a circle, waving Lolligan's men back to the safety of their makeshift wall. Arrows volleyed from the galley's deck and ricocheted from the abandoned rocks. Rhythmic cries erupted from the galley. Oars thrashed at the water, rotating the ship sidelong to the island. The galley began a slow advance. In moments, the archers on its forward deck would have clear fire on the barricade's flank. Shouts filled the air to the south. A dozen men rushed through the dark yards of the house, bows in hand. They swarmed up the stairs to a third-floor balcony, which was level with the firing platform on the galley. Two men pulled down the balcony's canvas roofing and draped it over the railing, providing some measure of cover for the others, who immediately rained fire on the archers in the galley. "Fall back!" Blaze yelled. Covered by the men on the deck, the soldiers pinned behind the fiery barricade raced toward the safety of the house, ducking low, shields held above their heads. Dante ran with them. Sporadic arrows whisked between them. One man fell, an arrow buried in his leg. Lyra ran back and helped him to his feet. Another band of reinforcements sprinted up from the pier. With the house between them and the galley, Dante took stock of the wounded. Four of Lolligan's men had died down on the shore. Another six had been shot or badly stabbed in the scrum. While those still fit to fight thumped across the house to get to the decks and fire on the galley, Dante called out the servants, who helped him bear the wounded into the dining hall. Dents in the rugs showed where chairs and tables had once stood. Now it was perfectly empty, the ideal place to stretch out the bleeding men and seeing to their wounds. Dante patched up the two unconscious men with the blood-hungry nether, then left the others to be bandaged by the maids and footmen. He ran outside onto the balcony. Men erupted in cheers. He grinned, but the noise wasn't for him. Past the dark shore, the galley had turned, thrashing northward across the lake. On the many decks of Lolligan's home, 60-odd mercenaries hollered, ringing their swords against their shields. Dante ran from deck to deck until he found Lolligan, Ulwin, and the woman in blue, whose clothes clung to her body, sodden with sweat and water and blood. They smiled from the balcony, watching the galley retreat.
"What are you standing there for?" Dante said. "Let's get on a boat and finish them off."
Lolligan smiled, but his eyes were creased with worry.
"I think we've done all we can tonight."
"What are you talking about? Their men are decimated, their sorcerer is wounded and weak. We can take them."
"He speaks to the future," agreed the woman in blue. "They attacked us first, in the concealing shadows of darkness. Who would say we don't have the right to fight back?"
Lolligan nodded.
"To hound them across the lake, however? To hunt them down and kill them? How do we argue that was a mistake? That it was forced upon us?"
Anger flashed over Dante, as much for this sudden split in solidarity as for the fact Cassander was escaping over the black waves.
"That man is one of the prime reasons the palace is pushing for war. Erasing him from the equation brings us one step closer to peace."
"Then there is tomorrow."
The woman in blue gestured at the dark blot of the galley.
"What if we spend our men tonight, and the dawn brings a fleet of the king's ships?
Not to mention potential pushback from Jacob's supporters in the Tagvog," Lolligan said. "If you want us to be able to stand with you and the Norren, we'll need the manpower to stand firm against our enemies here."
Exhaustion dropped on Dante like a fog. His muscles felt trembly, weakened by the climb up Jacob's water closet, the swim through cold waters, the battle on the shore. Sapped by the demands of the Nether, his mind felt like the longboat he'd hulled, sluggish, sinking beneath the surface of a cold abyss. It compromises us all, doesn't it? This struggle. Dante shivered. On the north shore, fires hissed as servants doused the mounded furniture with buckets of water. Bitter smoke boiled across the island. We'd better leave tonight, then. It'll be much easier for you to pass off whatever story you please when Jacob's killers aren't around to be questioned. Lolligan tipped back his head, eyes glinting in the moonlight.
That might be for the best. Do you still have my salt?
On the road, a small luxury can make all the difference. Dante smiled. I still have your salt.
All I ask is you save a pinch for whoever runs your kitchens.
He frowned at the city.
You should leave for your own safety, too. Menok knows what new horrors tomorrow will bring.
Blaze would advise you to tell as many different stories as you can, and let confusion win the battle for you. Lolligan chuckled, shaking his head.
Thanks for all your help. Let's meet again, in safer days.
Dante went downstairs to round up the others. The house smelled of blood and smoke. Lyra had a gash on her upper arm, and a fist-sized bruise on Blaze's chest was already magenta and swollen, but none of their group bore wounds that would slow them down. Hurriedly, they cleaned their swords and packed their clothes. A rowboat awaited them at the dock. At the stables, the boy rubbed his puffy eyes and slogged off to fetch their horses. Dante settled their accounts and rode east. Everyone was as tired as the stable hand, too exhausted to even ask where they were headed. Then again, maybe it was obvious. They were going home. Dawn spilled over the western mountains when they were halfway up the pass. They stopped for breakfast, or the world's latest supper. Green mountains ringed the long blue lake. Pillars of smoke rose from hundreds of different chimneys. Birds peeped from the branches, pecking at fresh buds and hard green seeds.
Pretty, isn't it? Blaze said.
I hope Modigan doesn't decide to burn the whole valley down. At least that would slow down his march on the territories, Dante said.
Lyra glanced up.
Was that what this was about?
Dante gave her a brief glare.
This was about letting a people choose their own leaders. Specifically leaders who want the same things we do.
I'm fine with what we did. Dante swung up into the saddle. His head thudded. It would be hours before they reached the next town, and the beds it would offer. Lyra's accusation followed him all the way.
Chapter 16. Ants scrambled in and out from the mouth of their sandy hill, unaware of their impending destruction. And what could they do if they knew? Run? Escape to the safety of their deepest tunnels? They certainly couldn't stop it. Their fear, their anger, the frantic waving of their antennae. None of it would make the slightest difference to the coming disaster. Kneeling in the dirt, Dante shaped a finger of Nether and pushed it into the top of the hill. He meant to dislodge a single grain. Instead, the rod of shadows shoved over the hill's entire top into a crumbling caldera. Ants wriggled in the sand, forcing their way into daylight and air. Dante stripped the shadows away until they were as nimble as a pin, then brushed sand up the half-ruined hill. Grain slid back into a lazy pile. If he wanted, he could push a boulder. He could crack the side of a cliff, shearing rubble into a lethal rain of falling rocks. he could pound the anthill into a hard-packed hole, killing everything inside it. But all that was physical brawn, nothing more. The people of the pocket hadn't been moving earth by brute force. They had reshaped it, made it grow like the body and branches of a tree. And however much Dante fiddled around in the dirt, he couldn't begin to replicate that. Still, he practiced during every stop they made along the eastward road. The mountains of Galador faded into the spring haze. Grass bent in the wind and danced in the rain. They saw no sign of pursuit from the lakelands. Still, they rode swiftly, trotting and walking until their horses grew tired, then swapping them out for their spares. He looned Cali 2 days out from Wending to let him know they may have led a revolution.
"Me?" Cali said. "What part is uncertain? The torches and pitchforks or your participation in waving them?"
"We don't know how it turned out," Dante said. "The king's soldiers might have come back and put it down."
"The king's soldiers?"
"The ones we fought." Dante sucked in his breath. "Unintentionally."
"Were they in disguise?"
"Uniforms."
"Were you?"
"Disguises wouldn't have helped. Cassander was leading them."
"So you fought, with swords and the like, against the king's own troops?"
Cali's fingernails clicked against something hard.
"Well, this ought to help the Norrin quite a bit."
"You think so?" Dante said.
"Certainly. Now Modigan will ignore them altogether and come straight for us instead."
"Cali, at this point, do you really think there's any hope we can stop this?"
"Sure, so long as every last Norrin agrees to a treaty they'll never ever agree to."
"That's what I thought.
Wending's merchants were ready to enlist themselves at the king's side. We just turned them into rebels."
Cali sighed.
"I suppose you've done me a favor. Now when I tell the council this is all your fault, I won't have to lie."
Pedestrians and horse teams trickled west, outnumbering the eastern traffic 10-1. After 2 days of this, curiosity got the best of Blaze, and he planted himself straight in the path of a man, his wife, and their 3 children, all on foot. The man stopped, stiff, fist clenched near his belt.
"Don't worry," Blaze said. "We're not bandits. Anymore. Why are you headed west?"
The man glanced at the odd assortment of Dante, Lyra, Moon, and Fan.
"To get out before the soldiers get in."
"Think it'll come to that?"
"Norrin won't budge."
The man gazed at Morn.
"Guess we have to instead."
Morn stared at the road.
"We're not the ones making threats."
The man tightened his fist. Blaze raised his eyebrow. The man hunched his back and continued down the road. Dante made no detours until the wheat fields of Tatonin. At the town of Shan, he broke north to Brant's estate. Again Brant opened the door himself, greeting them with a grin, his thick arms crossed over his gut.
"Heard you've been sowing troubled seeds."
"Doesn't sound like us," Blaze said. "Must have been some other Blaze."
"Funny. I heard 2 young men from Narashtovik fell in love with the daughter of some mucky-muck tea-monger. When they tried to abscond with the lady, the merchant objected, so they dumped a sack of tree cobras in his room while he slept."
"Definitely not us," Blaze said. "Me, I'm promised to my one and only. And as for him," he said, jerking a thumb at Dante, "I don't think he even knows what a woman is."
"Nonsense," Dante said. "They're the ones with the dresses and nice smells, aren't they?"
Brant beckoned them inside.
"Whatever the case, the whole deal wound up in some ripping nighttime brawl. Last I heard, King Modigan sent a half-dozen galleys upriver to put down the fighting."
Over dinner, Dante gave the farmer a more accurate, if censored, version of events,
and was happy to hear that not only had the clan of the Golden Field ceased their banditry, but were suspected of having slain a crew of human highwaymen who'd begun attacking wagons themselves. Narashtovic's first payment had already arrived, too. In response, the farmers had dispatched their first load of grain to the territories not 2 days ago.
"Nice to know one thing in the world's going well," Dante said.
"It's the best things have looked for us in years," Brant said. "If you could just get Modigan and the Norren to let go of each other's throats, we'd have to build you a statue."
They rode on. Smoke hung on the western plains. At a bridge over a swift and noisy stream, Blaze stopped to stock up on water and feed the horses. Dante picked through the reeds on the muddy banks and called to the nether, hiding under the algae-slick stones. Shaping it into a black stylus, he folded his hands in his lap and traced his name into the muck. Nether lurked in the mud, too, as well as in the water that welled up in the letters of his name. Pinpricks of darkness that he pooled in his palm. How could he speak to the soil, make it move in tune with the nether it contained? Shadows rushed to his hands. He pounded the nether into the mud, splattering himself and the stream, obliterating his name. 100 miles from Narashtovic, the Black Woods swallowed them up. Kali raised Dante on the loon and told him to hurry home. He wouldn't explain why. Dante resumed at a gallop. They reached the city in 2 days. Cold spring rains battered the rooftops, swirling the streets into a slurry of horse dung and mud. Men ran from the doorways with their hoods pulled tight over their heads. Atop the pride gate, guards watched Dante pass. They were as still as the rooftop gargoyles, rain ticking on their metal helmets. Compared to the ebullience of Thor's, the streets were desolate, tense, a place to be fled rather than enjoyed. At the gates of the sealed citadel, Dante pulled back his hood and called out his name. A guard leaned over the battlements and disappeared inside the gate tower. The portcullis cranked into the walls with a cacophony of clunks and shrieks. A footman splashed across the courtyard. Callie was waiting. Inside the keep, Dante shed his sopping cloak and jogged up the stairs, Blaze behind him. Callie sat behind his desk, tapping the blunt end of a quill into a blob of ink spilled on the surface of the dark wood. He nodded at them without looking up. His eyes were sunken, ringed with wine-dark circles. His white hair lay flat against his head. Blue veins traced his unusually pale face, as if he'd already joined Aron in the other world, where sunlight was a stranger, left to wander endless fields under the silver of the stars.
"You got here quick."
His voice was as flat as his hair.
"That's good."
Blaze rested his hand on the hilt of his sword.
"Either something's wrong or you're just starting to show your age. Since you haven't crumbled into a pile of dust, I'm guessing the former."
Callie smiled wryly at the spilled ink.
"Is it that easy to tell?"
"Oh, no. Only if you've got eyes." Callie dropped the quill and steepled his fingers against his chin.
"There was another riot in Dolendon. Modigan's troops marched across the river to put it down."
"They did.
They burned down half the Norren quarter, too."
"Are you kidding me?" Dante said.
"The clans have gone berserk. At last Count 23 had rejected the treaty. The chieftain of the clan of Twin Streams actually shoved his copy up his own ass just so he could shit it back out."
Dante pushed his fist into his forehead.
"I'm guessing Modigan didn't lay down his crown and do the apology dance."
Kelly gazed at the congealing ink. "I haven't received the official announcement yet.
But rumor, as always, outraces the sun. The clans have been outlawed. Any Norran who resists the commands of Gascon soldiers, lords or officials elected or appointed, is to be seized as property of the crown, or killed without penalty. Callie looked up, impossibly old. It's been decided. He's going to war.
Well, shit, Blaze said.
You're the one who's been saying this could happen all along, Dante said. Or was I getting you mixed up with some other 120-year-old head of the Council of the Sealed Citadel of Narashtavik?
The storm heads of Callie's brows collided.
Yes, but among the manifold risks and rewards of supporting the Norren, early war was literally the worst outcome. It's hardly fair.
Fair? Dante laughed. Even if this was our worst nightmare, I assume you planned for it.
That doesn't mean I have good plans. When the most powerful man in the known world decides to come stamp you into paste, there's not a whole lot planning can do for you.
You always have options, Dante said. You can always fight back.
Callie rolled his eyes, mustache twitching.
You can leap off a cliff, too, but it won't get you any closer to the moon.
Let's assume we've only got a few months left to our tragically brief lives, Blaze said. What's going to be the most fun for us to do in the meantime?
A smile fought through the thicket of the old man's beard.
Okay, fighting back.
Blaze thrust up his fist. So, let's take a cue from the Norren, stuff that treaty right up our ass, and shit it back out.
We're not doing that.
Then, at least, let us go drive those red-shirted sons of bitches out of the Norren territories.
The Council's going to hate this.
Callie smiled. Brace yourselves for shouting.
He scheduled the meeting for 4 days later. In the meantime, he dispatched riders to recall Ollivander from the villages of the eastern foothills, where he was running headcounts on men of fighting age, and to fetch Cav from his estate on the northwest shores. The rains continued, tumbling from the tight ceiling of clouds. Sometimes it poured down in great seaside squalls, solid sheets of water that flushed down the hills and flooded the basement of the barracks. At other times, the rain descended in a dewy mist, glomming Dante's eyelashes and slicking the cobbles. It was in such a rain that Callie insisted on taking Dante to the graveyard. Most of the graves on the northern hill were centuries old. A scant handful were adorned with the pine boughs marking the anniversary of their occupants' passage. Moss clung to the stone markers. Some of the tomb pillars had toppled, lying cracked in the weeds. Callie passed Larimore's marker, clean and white. Damp grass soaked the legs of Dante's pants. His cloak hung heavy and damp from his shoulders. His hands were as frigid as the dead.
Are we scouting your future resting place?
Dante slicked rain from his eyes. Or have you decided you'd rather die by a cold than a sword?
Callie glanced over his shoulder, his beard as disheveled as a dog after it crawls from a lake and gives its first shake.
This is for your benefit. You seem incapable of learning in civilized settings, so I thought I'd return our classroom to the site of your greatest success.
This is another lesson. I hope it's more useful than your last one.
If a sponge fails to absorb a puddle, you don't blame the puddle.
That's assuming the puddle is made of something that can be absorbed, rather than something thick and intransigent and altogether muddy.
Odd you should say that.
Callie stopped in front of a rain-churned flat of dirt and grass.
Mud is precisely what we're about to dive into.
Dante frowned at the grave-studded field.
I hope you're still speaking metaphorically.
Honestly, I'm not sure.
With some difficulty,
The old man knelt in the grass, splaying his hand into the muck.
Let's see if we can get this to move.
I was trying that the whole trip back here. Nothing came of it except a few dead ants.
That's because you are stubborn, and occasionally stupid.
Callie squinted at the sloppy ground.
My theory is that mud, being muddy, will be easier to move than rock, what with its rockiness. Yet we should think of both when we think of how to move either. The commonalities will allow us to stab nearly at the heart instead of flailing in the dark.
Dante knelt beside him, rain soaking into the knees of his pants.
They're both non-living substances. But do we know they're pure of life? What if these fine grains include bits of bone? What if the water that made this dirt mud once passed through a bear's bladder or a goat's veins?
Dante paused with his hand halfway to the mud.
Then this is a very disgusting world we live in. Few things have ever been only themselves. This is part of what I meant to impart to you about cycles. In a way, all the world is a Ron's mill, grinding old into new in a ceaseless turn.
If it's all the same substance, does that mean the rock is the nether, and the nether is the rock? Callie cocked his rain-sodden head, staring into the brown sludge as if Dante had just swept it aside to reveal a cache of rubies.
He shook his head sharply. No. We'd feel it, but that's good thinking. What else?
Absently, Dante picked up a twig and began drawing a bunny in the mud. He stopped with the second ear half sketched.
What if there is no stick?
You're beginning to talk like me. I don't like it.
To draw a rabbit, I have to use this stick.
He held it up. Mud clumped around its tip. If I want to knock down one of those grave pillars, I have to call the nether to me, shape it, and send it slamming into the rock. What if I found a way to throw out the stick?
Callie's eyes slitted. He snatched away the stick and poked at the wet soil. Now that is an idea.
Dante burrowed his focus into the mud, plumbing it for drops and trickles of shadows. He grabbed these up and tried to shake them like a dog shakes a squirrel. Callie smacked him in the side of the head, just hard enough to dislodge his hold on them.
What the hell was that for?
Dante said, rubbing his head through his hood.
Don't just trample in like a puppy that's caught its first whiff of cheese. That's your whole problem. Look.
Callie's eyelids drooped. His eyes became as cloudy as the rain pooling in the dirt. Dante looked, too. Shadows webbed the mud, infesting it, inhabiting it, embedded within and containing it, diffusing it like cream stirred in tea, yet as separate from it as the planks of a wrecked ship or from the swirl of a maelstrom. He didn't touch the nether, except to trace it with his mental fingers. He simply watched, looked, and listened. After a full hour, Callie unfolded his legs with a grunt. He stood and stretched and flapped his rain-soaked cloak.
Well, I suppose that's enough of that. Try to work this out, though, won't you? You could stroll across the territories founding new forts with a snap of your fingers.
Why don't you figure it out?
Dante shivered.
You're supposed to be the master.
Yes, and the main perk of being the master is making your apprentices do your work for you.
The old man strode down the hill, stiff from the cold. The upcoming meeting of the council was entirely Callie's business, leaving Dante with no immediate responsibilities for the first time since thaws. He spent most of the following days
watching the dirt. Twice, he tried to move it, but with the nether embedded in the solid soil, rather than collected and shaped in his hands, it was like trying to push a wall. Perhaps it was even more like trying to push a mountain. The rains came and went. So did the riders, passing through the citadel gates with news from the outlands and heartlands. Several clans had begun organized raids on the human border towns. Casualties had so far been light, a few soldiers and guards, a couple Norrin warriors. The first of Modigan's conscripts, 400 men from the Hapok lowlands, were said to be inbound as an emergency stopgap against the clans. At the pub, Blaze nodded at the news. "That'll keep the local taverns in business. Zero of those men are going to step outside whatever town they're parked in." "Think so," Dante said. "For certain," Lyra said. "It'll be weeks before they have the strength to start striking out in force. It could be months." Dante frowned. "Well, that's not how I would do it. The clans rarely number more than 50 people. If I were commanding the border troops, I would split them into three forces. 150 to guard whatever cities at greatest risk, 150 ranging far afield to keep the clan scrambling, and the remaining 100 troops on regular sweeps between their base in town and the neighboring regions. This third force could reinforce the rangers when called for, too." "Fiendishly strategic," Blaze said. "Unless the Norrin decide one clan plus one clan equals all your men are dead." "So you'd just sit in town and twiddle your thumbs?"
"Do I look like a coward?"
"I can't tell with your back turned like that." Blaze snorted. "Modigan doesn't need any bold stratagems and daring do. Do you know how huge his empire is? He can just advance town by town, county by county, hill by hill, the same way Mourn plays Nulladoon, the same way time decays us all to empty dirt." "That's a bit dark," Dante said. Blaze took a long pull of his pale brown, a spring blend of spiced rum and citrusy wheat beer. "You've spent enough time with the clans, Mourn. Do you really think a few scattered tribes can do anything to stop an army of 20,000 men? Mourn rolled his mug between his hairy hands.
"That question is dishonest. If all you do is compare a small number to a big number, the small number will never be the favorite."
"Well, that's all it is," Blaze said. "A numbers game. They've got them. We don't." Dante set down his mug, arranging it so the handle faced him perfectly. "What about what you told Callie the other day? That we have to fight back?"
"Of course we'll fight back. But that won't mean we'll win."
The table went silent. The smell of roasted lamb hung in the air, greasy and savory, undershot by boiled carrots and garlic and onions. Men murmured, mugs clunking. Their grim tones and slow words echoed Blaze's mood.
"Are you all right?" Dante said.
Blaze gazed out the smeary window to the street, which was nearly pitch black, other than the rain gleaming in deep pools. "I just wonder if we've done the right thing. We do these things, and at the time they look right, but you come home and you put them together, and somehow they've added up to this bullshit war. If that's the result of all those good decisions, maybe they weren't so good in the first place."
"But they would look different if Modigan had responded different," Mourn said. "If he only responds with badness, our decisions will look like wrongness no matter what we do."
"That's the truth right there." Lyra gripped Blaze's wrist. "You have to do what your heart and head tells you is best, no matter how the world might lash back. If you don't do what you know is right, how can right ever happen?" Dante kept his peace. That wasn't quite how he saw it. If getting eaten by a bear struck you as unfair, then perhaps you should keep your hands off a mother's cubs. But the discussion had already moved into the safe room of platitudes. Blaze drained his cup, plunked it down, and walked to the bar without a word. Dante scuffed his boots across the gritty floor, then ran his mind across the dirt there, seeking out the pricks of shadows contained within the grains. Morn nodded at the bar.
I think he is in trouble.
He'll be fine, Dante said absently. Everyone has moments of shadow.
And Blazes are about to manifest in the punching of that man.
Dante twisted in his chair. At the bar, Blaze faced down a man whose fists and mouth were bunched in anger. The man stepped forward, shoulders rolling beneath his deer fur coat, throwing Blaze into his shadow. His shoulders were those of a smith or a woodcutter, a man who spent all day swinging something heavy and metal. Blaze smiled, swaying.
Is this how you met your wife? Who can say no after they've been beaten into sleep?
The man cocked his fist and threw a looping right hook. Blaze stepped inside it, flicking his left wrist along the man's incoming arm to take control of the punch. In the same motion, he turned his hips and straightened up on his bent knees, driving a hard uppercut straight into the man's advancing chin. His teeth clicked so hard, Dante winced. The man reeled backwards like gravity had just turned sidelong. He banged into the chairs behind him, knocking another man to the ground with a yelp. A mug shattered. The man hung there from the chairs, muttering to himself, eyes fluttering. Blaze grabbed the downed man's drink and gulped it down. Two men broke through the pressing onlookers. Like their half-conscious friend, they, too, had the hard-hewn arms of woodcutters. Blaze flipped the empty mug at their feet.
Back the fuck off or join him on the floor!
Morn ploughed up to the bar, Lyra and Dante behind him. The taller of the woodcutters leaned toward Blaze.
Apologize. Do it good enough and I won't take your jaw away. None of that is going to happen,
Morn said, dropping his voice even lower than its typical rumble of falling rocks. The two men turned. They tipped back their heads to meet Moon's eyes. The fight fled from their faces.
"What's this?" the man said. "Start up trouble, then send in your slave to bail you out?"
"Slaves aren't allowed to strike citizens."
Morn advanced, broad-bowed as a war galley.
I'm not a slave.
Dante wedged his way between them, dwarfed on all sides.
It's time to stop doing dumb things. Then start by getting out of my way, the woodcutter said.
Dante pulled back his cloak to expose the silver and sapphire brooch of the white tree. The woodcutter lowered his hands, expression turning pensive.
We didn't come for trouble, sir, but I just saw my friend get punched by this whining mosquito here.
Then maybe you should see if he's all right. Dante tipped his head at Blaze. That one happens to be my friend. We'll see he gets safely home.
I'm not going anywhere.
Blaze pointed at the man he'd punched, who had lowered himself to the floor, head held between his hands.
He bumped into me.
Dante bulged his eyes.
There's plenty to drink at the Citadel.
Blaze rolled his eyes.
Fine. I think I'll go vomit on your bed.
I'll go with him,
Morn said.
I don't need a nursemaid, Blaze said, unless she's a damn sight less hairy than you.
And I don't like the way I'm being stared at.
Morn rested his hand on Blaze's shoulder.
Come on.
They left, followed by the steady gaze of the crowd. The woodcutters helped their friend to his feet. Dante returned to their table and pulled out a chair for Lyra. She swept off her cloak,
face flushed with battle spirit, and let out a long breath. A hunched and wizened beer boy had followed them to the table, rightly guessing they'd be in the mood for a drink. Lyra ordered two more pale browns.
"I hope he's all right," she said after the drinks had arrived.
"He put that man down without getting touched," Dante said. "That woodcutter will be wearing Blazer's knuckle prints for a beard for the next week." She glanced at the door, as if Blaze might have snuck back in, then leaned across the table, breasts pressing against her doublet. Involuntarily, Dante remembered how she'd fallen beneath the servant's towel as they dried themselves at Galador, those flashes of pink and white. "I mean, what he was talking about before. He sounded defeated." "It gets to him sometimes." Dante shifted in his chair. "This isn't baking pies. Our business requires making people unhappy. Sometimes we have to make them dead." She held there, half stretched across the table, eyes steady.
"It doesn't get to you?"
"Only when I can afford to let it."
"And what do you do then?"
"Read. Research. Learn the Nether." Lyra leaned back and sipped her drink. "Just like I stretch or run or practice my forms. I suppose that's best. The only person you can always count on is yourself." He drank, too, buying himself a moment. The room felt suddenly warm. Thick, too. Lyra's words felt like a letter written long ago, thick with references long lost to time, impenetrable. He took another drink. "I found a few people I can count on," he said. "But you have to hold them close. It's so easy to get lost in the wind." She met his eyes and nodded. They finished their mugs and another round after that. The crowd thinned. "There's something I don't understand," Dante said. Lyra glanced away from the window.
"Just the one thing?"
"Among the universe of things I don't understand, there is one thing I would like you to help me understand right now," he amended. "How can you be so inflexible?"
"I'm guessing you're not talking about my joint locks."
Dante shook his head. "Not unless your ethics have joints. And if they do, they're bad ones, because I'm pretty sure there's a lot of stuff you'd never bend on."
"Like what?"
"Like, if it came down to you or me, your silly vow would convince you to sacrifice yourself." She raised a brow. "You wouldn't do the same for these Norren of yours?" He sloshed his mug. "Not a chance."
"What are you talking about? I've seen you put your life at risk for them a dozen times."
"That's different. I don't know I'm going to die. In general, I'm foolishly certain I won't. But if I were ever in a situation where I knew with perfect certainty it would be my life or their freedom," he shrugged, "you would be left staring at the cloud of dust in the spot I had just vacated with all haste." Lyra smiled at the corner of the ceiling.
"I suppose you think you're being a clear-eyed, pragmatic realist."
"Are you scoffing at me?"
"You're scoffing.
Well, if the king and all his men strolled up to you with their swords and said, 'Listen, declare the Norren should be slaves or I'll run you through,' I don't see what's so noble about telling the truth and being skewered like a truth-telling pig. What good does that do anyone?"
"Because,"
she leaned back, waving her hand over the table.
"No.
I've had too much rum. I'll say no more."
"What?"
"It's stupid." Dante waggled his empty mug. "Well, I've had too much too, and will surely forget whatever is stupid by morning, so out with it." She rubbed her forehead with the back of her hand.
If the king were in front of me, I'd tell him the truth. The Norren should be freed.
But you'd be stabbed. To death.
It doesn't matter.
Lyra laughed at herself and shot him a quick glance before looking back to the cup in her hand.
I believe that if I impose my will on the world will bend.
Dante blinked.
Wait, like sorcery?
Why didn't you tell me?
No, not like that at all. I believe that when you stand up for what's right despite the consequences, because of the consequences, people take notice. Your will changes their minds. And maybe there is a mystical component too, like if the gods see right action, it reminds them to change the world for the better.
She glanced up.
Is that stupid?
No.
He set his mug on the table so gently it made no sound.
No. It's beautiful.
For a fleeting instant, her smile was happy, light. Then it became ironic once more.
But you disagree.
I don't know. I don't think you can count on men or gods to remember what's right. To pick up the torch of your cause after kings and demons have struck it from your hands. If you want to change the world for the good, you have to be willing to put on the mask of the villain.
Even if it means lying, killing, betraying all other values you hold dear.
If that's what it takes.
If it takes wrong to do good, then how do you know you're doing good at all?
She drained her cup and clunked it down.
Well, I've embarrassed myself enough. Shall we leave?
They rose together, smiling and unsteady. In the streets, rain misted from black skies, hissing on the corner torches that burned with the smell of whale fat. Lyra said something about the rain and sins. He laughed, his own voice racketing down the empty street. As they approached the inn gate, the clouds tore wide open, battering them with sheets of icy water.
Dante grabbed her hand and ran for the gate.
Beneath its stone cover, they laughed again, breath curling from their mouths. Lyra flung her hand at the pounding rain.
What do you say happens first? That stops, or Modigan sticks our heads on pikes.
Who cares? Dante said. He grabbed her belt and pulled her to him. Her lips were rain-cooled. Her mouth tasted like hops and sliced orange. For a moment as sharp as shattered glass, she was there with him, alive and bright beneath the gates, together in a pocket of safety from the rain and cold and the darkness.
She drew back, stiff.
He cocked his head.
She shook hers briskly.
He stepped away. She turned to the rain, still tumbling from the sky.
It's just rain, isn't it?
What are we afraid of?
She walked into the night. Rain beat Dante's hood. In the citadel courtyard, he said good night. He took a fat bottle of beer with him to bed. Candles blown out. He listened to the rain against the window.
On the whole, we failed, Callie said. We failed so thoroughly, you'd think it was our express mission.
Several members of the council voiced objections. Callie just laughed from behind his chair at the table, hands clasped at his back.
Don't cry out against me, look at the facts. Modigan came down with demands that couldn't possibly be met. The Norren have been pushed from sullen discontent into outright rebellion. The western counties have already sent their first musters to Setevan, whose standing troops have already been dispatched to the borders. All the while, we've stood back, hands washed, faces innocent.
Not that innocent,
Cav said. Yes, well, shit happens. At the very least, we didn't push as hard as we could.
We made no counter-threats against Modigan, no alternate treaties suggesting that Narashtavik be made steward of the territories, for instance, or that the capital abolish slavery in exchange for the official registration and restriction of the clans. Instead, we operated through half-measures, and now we're left with a complete disaster.
Wint wrinkled his sharp nose. Is this going where I think it's going?